From the Karak Mountains, overlooking the vast cold Stow Plain, in the middle of which Ankh-Morpork sprawled like a bag of dropped groceries, the view was particularly impressive. Mishits and ricochets from the magical battle were expanding outwards and upwards in a bowl-shaped cloud of curdled air at the heart of which strange lights flashed and sparkled. The roads leading away from it were packed with refugees, and every inn and wayside tavern was crowded out, or nearly everyone. No one seemed to want to stop at the rather pleasant little pub nestling among the trees just off the road to Quirm. It wasn't that they were frightened to go inside, it was just that, for the moment, they weren't being allowed to notice it. There was a disturbance in the air about half a mile away, and three figures dropped out of nowhere into a thicket of lavender. They lay supine in the sunshine among the broken, fragrant branches, until their sanity came back. Then Creosote said,
"Where are we, do you suppose?"
"It smells like someone's underwear drawer," said Kanina.
"Not mine," said Nigel, firmly. He eased himself up gently and added, "Has anyone seen the lamp?"
"Forget it. It's probably been sold to build a wine bar," said Kanina. Nigel scrabbled around among the lavender stems until his hands found something small and metallic.
"Got it," he declared. "Don't rub it," said the other two in harmony.
They were too late anyway, but that didn't much matter, because all that happened when Nigel gave it a cautious buff was the appearance of some small smoking red letters in mid-air.
"Hi," Nigel read aloud. "Do not put down the lamp, because your custom is important to us. Please leave a wish after the tone, and very shortly it will be our command. In the meantime, have a nice eternity."
He added, "You know, I think he's a bit overcommitted." Kanina said nothing. She was staring out across the plains to the broiling storm of magic. Occasionally some of it would detach and soar away to some distant tower. She shivered, despite the growing heat of the day. "We ought to get down there as soon as possible," she said. "It's very important."
"Why?"
said Creosote. One glass of wine hadn't really restored him to his former easy-going nature. Kanina opened her mouth and, quite unusually for her, shut it again. There was no way to explain that every gene in her body was dragging her onwards, telling her that she should get involved. Visions of swords and spiky balls on chains kept invading the hairdressing salons of her consciousness. Nigel, on the other hand, felt no such pounding. All he had to drive him onwards was imagination. But he did have enough of that to float a medium-sized war galley. He looked toward the city with what would have been, but for his lack of chin, an expression of set-jawed determination. Creosote realized that he was outnumbered.
"Do they have any drink down there?"
he said.
"Lots," said Nigel.
"That might do for a start," the Seraph conceded. "All right, lead on, O peach-breasted daughter of—"
"And no poetry." They untangled themselves from the thicket and walked down the hillside until they reached the road, which before very long went past the aforementioned tavern, or as Creosote persisted in calling it, Caravanserai. They hesitated about going in. It didn't seem to welcome visitors. But Kanina, who by breeding and upbringing tended to skulk around the back of buildings, found four horses tethered in the yard. They considered them carefully.
"It would be stealing," said Nigel slowly.
Kanina opened her mouth to agree, and the words, "Why not?" slid past her lips. She shrugged.
"Perhaps we should leave some money," Nigel suggested.
"Don't look at me," said Creosote.
"Or maybe write a note and leave it under the bridle, or something, don't you think?"
By way of an answer, Kanina vaulted up onto the largest horse, which by the look of it belonged to a soldier. Weaponry was slung all over it. Creosote hoisted himself uneasily onto the second horse, a rather skittish bay, and sighed.
"She's got that letterbox look," he said. "I should do what she says."
Nigel regarded the other two horses suspiciously. One of them was very large and extremely white. Not the off-white, which was all that most horses could manage, but a translucent ivory-white tone which Nigel felt an unconscious urge to describe as shroud. It also gave him a distinct impression that it was more intelligent than he was. He selected the other one. It was a bit thin, but docile, and he managed to get on after only two tries. They set off. The sound of their hoofbeats barely penetrated the gloom inside the tavern. The innkeeper moved like someone in a dream. He knew he had customers. He'd even spoken to them. He could even see them sitting round a table by the fire, but if asked to describe who he'd talked to and what he had seen, he'd have been at a loss. This is because the human brain is remarkably good at shutting out things it doesn't want to know. His could currently have shielded a bank vault. And the drinks. Most of them he'd never heard of, but strange bottles kept appearing on the shelves above the beer barrels. The trouble was that whenever he tried to think about it, his thoughts just slid away. The figures around the table looked up from their cards. One of them raised a hand. It stuck on the end of his arm, and it's got five fingers, the innkeeper's mind said. It must be a hand. One thing the innkeeper's brain couldn't shut out was the sound of the voices. This one sounded as though someone was hitting a rock with a roll of sheet lead.
Bar person!
The innkeeper groaned faintly. The thermic lances of horror were melting their way steadily through the steel door of his mind.
Let me see now. That's, what was it again?
A Bloody Mary!
This voice made a simple drinks order sound like the opening of hostilities.
Oh, yes. And...
Mine was a small eggnog,
said Pestilence.
An eggnog.
With a cherry in it.
Good,
lied the heavy voice.
And that'll be a small port wine for me, and...
The speaker glanced across the table at the fourth member of the quartet and sighed,
You'd better bring another bowl of peanuts.
About 300 yards down the road, the horse thieves were trying to come to terms with a new experience.
Certainly a smooth ride,
Nigel managed eventually.
And a lovely, lovely view, said Creosote, his voice lost in the slipstream.
But I wonder, said Nigel, if we have done exactly the right thing.
We're moving, aren't we? Demanded Canina. Don't be so petty.
It's just that, well, looking at cumulus clouds from above is...
Shut up.
Sorry. Anyway, they're stratus. Stratocumulus at most.
Right, said Nigel miserably. Does it make any difference? Said Creosote,
who was lying flat on his horse's neck with his eyes shut.
About 1,000 feet.
Oh.
Could be 750, conceded Canina.
Ah!
The Tower of Sorcery trembled. Coloured smoke rolled through its vaulted rooms and shining corridors. In the big room at the very tip, where the air was thick and greasy and tasted of burning tin, many wizards had passed out with the sheer mental effort of the battle, but enough remained. They sat in a wide circle, locked in concentration. It was just possible to see the shimmering in the air as the raw sorcery swirled out of the staff in Coin's hand and into the centre of the octagram. Outlandish shapes appeared for a brief instant and vanished. The very fabric of reality was being put through the ringer in there. Carding shuddered and turned away in case he saw anything he really couldn't ignore. The surviving senior wizards had a simulacrum of the disc hovering in front of them. As Carding looked at it again, the little red glow over the city of Quirm flared and went out. The air creaked.
There goes Quirm, murmured Carding.
That just leaves Al-Kali, said one of the others.
There's some clever power there.
Carding nodded glumly. He'd quite liked Quirm, which was had been a pleasant little city overlooking the Rim Ocean. He dimly recalled being taken there once when he was small. For a moment he gazed sadly into the past. It had wild geraniums, he recalled, filling the sloping cobbled streets with their musky fragrance.
"Growing out of the walls," he said out loud. "Pink."
They were. Pink. The other wizards looked at him oddly. One or two, of a particularly paranoid frame of mind, even for wizards, glanced suspiciously at the walls.
"Are you all right?" said one of them.
Said Carding. "Oh, yes. Sorry. Miles away." He turned back to look at Coin, who was sitting off to one side of the circle with the staff across his knees. The boy appeared to be asleep. Perhaps he was. But Carding knew in the tormented pit of his soul that the staff didn't sleep. It was watching him, testing his mind. It knew. It even knew about the pink geraniums.
"I never wanted it to be like this," he said softly.
"All we really wanted was a bit of respect."
"Are you sure you're all right?"
Carding nodded vaguely. As his colleagues resumed their concentration, he glanced sideways at them. Somehow, all his old friends had gone. Well, not friends. A wizard never had friends, at least not friends who were wizards. It needed a different word. Ah, yes, there it was. Enemies. but a very decent class of enemies, gentlemen, the cream of their profession, not like these people. For all that, they seem to have risen in the craft since the sorcerer had arrived. Other things besides the cream floated to the top, he reflected sourly. He turned his attention to Al-Khali, probing with his mind, knowing that the wizards there were almost certainly doing the same, seeking constantly for a point of weakness. He thought, am I a point of weakness? Spelter tried to tell me something. It was about the staff. A man should lean on his staff, not the other way round. It's steering him, leading him. I wish I'd listened to Spelter. This is wrong. I'm a point of weakness. He tried again, riding the surges of power, letting them carry his mind into the enemy tower. Even Abrim was making use of sorcery, and Carding let himself modulate the wave, insinuating himself past the defences erected against him. The image of the interior of the Al-Khali Tower appeared, focused. The luggage trundled along the glowing corridors. It was exceedingly angry now. It had been awoken from hibernation, it had been scorned, it had been briefly attacked by a variety of mythological and now extinct life forms. It had a headache, and now, as it entered the great hall, it detected the hat. The horrible hat, the cause of everything it was currently suffering. It advanced purposely. Carding, testing the resistance of Abrim's mind, felt the man's attention waver. For a moment he saw through the enemy's eyes, saw the squat oblong cantering across the stone. For a moment Abrim attempted to shift his concentration, and then, no more able to help himself than is a cat when it sees something small and squeaky run across the floor, Carding struck. Not much. It didn't need much. Abrim's mind was attempting to balance and channel huge forces, and it needed hardly any pressure to topple it from its position. Abrim extended his hands to blast the luggage, gave the merest beginnings of a scream, and imploded. The wizards around him thought they saw him grow impossibly small in a fraction of a second and vanish, leaving a black afterimage. The more intelligent of them started to run, and the magic he had been controlling surged back out and flooded free in one great, randomized burst that blew the hat to bits, took out the entire lower levels of the tower, and quite a large part of what remained of the city. So many wizards in Ankh had been concentrating on the hall that the sympathetic resonance blew them across the room. Carding ended up on his back, his hat over his eyes. They hauled him out and dusted him off and carried him to Coin and the staff amid cheers, although some of the older wizards forbore to cheer, but he didn't seem to pay any attention. He stared sightlessly down at the boy and then slowly raised his hands to his ears. "Can't you hear them?" he said. The wizards fell silent. Carding still had power, and the tone of his voice would have quelled a thunderstorm. Coin's eyes glowed. "I hear nothing," he said. Carding turned to the rest of the wizards. "Can't you hear them?" They shook their heads. One of them said, "Hear what, brother?" Carding smiled, and it was a wide, mad smile. Even Coin took a step backwards. "You'll hear them soon enough," he said. "You've made a beacon. You'll all hear them. But you won't hear them for long." He pushed aside the younger wizards who were holding his arms and advanced on Coin. "You're pouring sorcery into the world and other things are coming with it," he said. "Others have given them a pathway, but you've given them an avenue." He sprang forwards and snatched the black staff out of Coin's hands and swung it up in the air to smash it against the wall. Carding went rigid as the staff struck back. Then his skin began to blister. Most of the wizards managed to turn their heads away. A few, and there are always a few like that, watched in obscene fascination. Coin watched too. His eyes widened in wonder. One hand went to his mouth. He tried to back away. He couldn't. "There, Cumulus." "Oh, marvellous," said Nigel weakly.
"Weight doesn't come into it. My steed has carried armies, my steed has carried cities, yea, he hath carried all things in their due time," said Death. "But he's not going to carry you three."
"Why not?"
"It's a matter of the look of the thing."
"It's going to look pretty good then, isn't it?" said War testily. "The one horseman and the three pedestrians of the apocalypse?" "Perhaps you could ask them to wait for us,"
said Pestilence, his voice sounding like something dripping out of the bottom of a coffin.
"I have things to attend to,"
said Death. He made a little clicking noise with his teeth.
"I'm sure you'll manage. You normally do."
War watched the retreating horse.
"Sometimes he really gets on my nerves. Why is he always so keen to have the last word?"
he said.
"Horse of habit, I suppose."
They turned back to the tavern. Neither spoke for some time, and then War said,
"Where's Famine?" "Went to find the kitchen."
"Oh." War scuffed one armoured foot in the dust, and thought about the distance to Ankh. It was a very hot afternoon. The apocalypse could jolly well wait.
"One for the road," he suggested.
"Should we?"
said Pestilence, doubtfully.
"I thought we were expected. I mean, I wouldn't like to disappoint people."
"We've got time for a quick one, I'm sure,"
War insisted.
"Pub clocks are never right. We've got bags of time. All the time in the world."
Carding slumped forward and thudded on the shining white floor. The staff rolled out of his hands and upended itself. Coyne prodded the limp body with his foot.
"I did warn him," he said. "I told him what would happen if he touched it again. What did he mean, them?"
There was an outbreak of coughing and a considerable inspection of fingernails.
"What did he mean?"
Coyne demanded. Ovin Harcardley, lecturer in law, once again found that the wizards around him were parting like morning mist. Without moving, he appeared to have stepped forward. His eyes swiveled backwards and forwards like trapped animals.
"Ah," he said. He waved his thin hands vaguely. "The world, you see, that is, the reality in which we live, in fact, it can be thought of as, in a manner of speaking, a rubber sheet."
He hesitated, aware that the sentence was not going to appear in anyone's book of quotable quotes.
"In that," he added hurriedly, "it is distorted, distended, by the presence of magic in any degree, and if I may make a point here, too much magical potentiality, if foregathered in one spot, forces our reality, downwards. Although, of course, one should not take the term literally, because in no sense do I seek to suggest a physical dimension, and it has been postulated that a sufficient exercise of magic can, shall we say, break through the actuality at its lowest point, and offer, perhaps, a pathway to the inhabitants, or, if I may use a more correct term, denizens of the lower plane, which is called by the loose-tongued the dungeon dimensions, who, because perhaps of the difference in energy levels, are naturally attracted to the brightness of this world. Our world."
There was the typical long pause which usually followed Harcardley's speeches, while everybody mentally inserted commas and stitched the fractured clauses together. Coyne's lips moved silently for a while.
"Do you mean magic attracts these creatures?"
he said eventually. His voice was quite different now. It lacked its former edge. The staff hung in the air above the prone body of Carding, rotating slowly. The eyes of every wizard in the place were on it.
"So it appears," said Harcardley. "Students of such things say their presence is heralded by a coarse susurration."
Coyne looked uncertain.
"They buzz," said one of the other wizards helpfully.
The boy knelt down and peered closely at Carding.
"He's very still," he said curiously. "Is anything bad happening to him?"
"It may be," said Harcardley guardedly. "He's dead."
"I wish he wasn't."
"It is a view, I suspect, which he shares."
"But I can help him," said Coyne. He held out his hands, and the staff glided into them. If it had a face, it would have smirked. When he spoke next, his voice once again had the cold, distant tones of someone speaking in a steel room.
"If failure had no penalty, success would not be a prize," he said.
"Sorry," said Harcardley,
"you've lost me there."
Coyne turned on his heel and strode back to his chair.
"We can fear nothing," he said, and it sounded more like a command. "What of these dungeon dimensions? If they should trouble us, away with them. A true wizard will fear nothing. Nothing." He jerked to his feet again and strode to the simulacrum of the world. The image was perfect in every detail, down to a ghost of Great Artuin paddling slowly through the interstellar deeps a few inches above the floor. Coin waved his hand through it all disdainfully. "Ours is a world of magic," he said, "and what can be found in it that can stand against us?" Harkardly thought that something was expected of him. "Absolutely no one," he said, "except for the gods, of course." There was dead silence.
"The gods?" said Coin quietly.
"Well, yes, certainly. We don't challenge the gods. They do their job, we do ours. No sense in—" "Who rules the disk, wizards or gods?"
Harkardly thought quickly.
"Oh, wizards, of course, but as it were, under the gods."
When one accidentally puts one boot in a swamp, it is quite unpleasant, but not as unpleasant as pushing down with the other boot and hearing that, too, disappear with a soft sucking noise. Harkardly pressed on.
"You see, wizardry is more—"
"Are we not more powerful than the gods, then?" said Coin.
Some of the wizards at the back of the crowd began to shuffle their feet.
"Well, yes and no," said Harkardly, up to his knees in it now.
The truth was that wizards tended to be somewhat nervous about the gods. The beings who dwelt on Cori Celesti had never made their feelings plain on the subject of ceremonial magic, which, after all, had a certain godness about it, and wizards tended to avoid the whole subject. The trouble with gods was that if they didn't like something, they didn't just drop hints. So common sense suggested that it was unwise to put the gods in a position where they had to decide.
"There seems to be some uncertainty," said Coin.
"If I may counsel," Harkardly began.
Coin waved a hand. The walls vanished. The wizards stood at the top of the Tower of Sorcery, and as one man their eyes turned to the distant pinnacle of Cori Celesti, home of the gods.
"When you've beaten everyone else, there's only the gods left to fight," said Coin. "Have any of you seen the gods?"
There was a chorus of hesitant denials.
"I will show them to you."
"You got room for another one in there, old son?" said War.
Pestilence swayed unsteadily.
"I'm sure we should be getting along,"
he muttered, without much conviction.
"No, go on."
"Just a half, then, and then we really must be going."
War slapped him on the back and glared at Famine.
"And we'd better have another 15 bags of peanuts," he added.
"Ook,"
the librarian concluded.
"Oh," said Rincewind, "it's the staff that's the problem, then."
"Ook.
Hasn't anyone tried to take it away from him?"
"Ook."
"What happened to them, then?"
"Ook."
Rincewind groaned. The librarian had put his candle out because the presence of the naked flame was unsettling the books. But now that Rincewind had grown accustomed to the dark, he realized it wasn't dark at all. The soft octarine glow from the books filled the inside of the tower with something that, while it wasn't exactly light, was a blackness you could see by. Now and again the ruffle of stiff pages floated down from the gloom.
"So basically there's no way our magic could defeat him, isn't that right?"
The librarian ooked disconsolate agreement and continued to spin around gently on his bottom.
"Pretty pointless, then. It may have struck you that I am not exactly gifted in the magical department. I mean, any duel is going to go along the lines of, 'Hello, I'm Rincewind,' closely followed by 'Bazam.'"
"Ook."
"Basically, what you're saying is that I'm on my own."
"Ook."
"Thanks."
By their own faint glow, Rincewind regarded the books that had stacked themselves around the inner walls of the ancient tower. He sighed and marched briskly to the door, but slowed down noticeably as he reached it.
"I'll be off, then," he said.
"Ook."
"To face who knows what dreadful perils," Rincewind added. "To lay down my life in the service of mankind." "All right. Bipeds."
"Oof."
"And quadrupeds, all right."
He glanced at the patrician's jam jar, a beaten man.
"And lizards," he added. "Can I go now?"
A gale was howling down out of a clear sky as Rincewind toiled towards the Tower of Sorcery. Its high white doors were shut so tightly that it was barely possible to see their outline in the milky surface of the stone. He hammered on it for a bit, but nothing much happened. The doors seemed to absorb the sound. "Fine thing," he muttered to himself, and remembered the carpet. It was lying where he had left it, which was another sign that Ankh had changed. In the thieving days before the sorcerer, nothing stayed for long where you left it. Nothing printable, anyway. He rolled it out on the cobbles, so that the golden dragons writhed against the blue ground. Unless, of course, the blue dragons were flying against a golden sky. He sat down. He stood up. He sat down again and hitched up his robe, and with some effort, unrolled one of his socks. Then he replaced his boot and wandered around a bit until he found, among the rubble, a half-brick. He inserted the half-brick into the sock, and gave the sock a few thoughtful swings. Rincewind had grown up in Morpork. What a Morpork citizen likes to have on his side in a fight was odds of about 20-1. But failing that, a sock full of half-brick and a dark alley to lurk in was generally considered a better bet than any two magic swords you cared to name. He sat down again. "Up," he commanded. The carpet did not respond. Rincewind peered at the pattern, then lifted a corner of the carpet and tried to make out if the underside was any better. "All right," he conceded. "Down, very, very carefully, down." "Sheep," slurred War. "It was sheep." His helmeted head hit the bar with a clang. He raised it again. "Sheep."
"No, no, no,"
said Famine, raising a thin finger unsteadily.
"Some other tame animal, like pig, heifer. Kitten? Like that. Not sheep."
"Bees," said Pestilence, and slid gently out of his seat.
"Okay," said War, ignoring him. "Right. Once again, then, from the top."
He rapped the side of his glass for the note.
"We are poor little unidentified domesticated animals that have lost our way," he quavered.
"Bah, bah, bah."
"Ah," muttered Pestilence from the floor. War shook his head.
"It is the same, you know," he said. "Not without him. He used to come in beautifully on the bass."
"Bah, bah, bah,"
Pestilence repeated.
"Oh, shut up,"
said War, and reached uncertainly for a bottle.